Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Sam in the Morning, only on LA Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the show. Today is Tuesday, August 23rd. We've got a great show for you. Hi, Tori.
Hello, Sam.
How's it going?
It's going well.
Anything interesting in the paper this morning?
A lot of bad news.
Yeah?
I was looking for something good to see. They did create a see-through mouse.
A see-through mouse?
Yes.
And that's a living mouse?
Correct. They turned an entire mouse, including its muscles and internal organs, transparent while illuminating the nerve pathways that run throughout its body.
Wow.
And the technique is called U-Disco.
Oh, yeah?
Which seems really weird. For like, I think because it's like neon, but it's not for the mouse. I don't think that's cool.
Yeah. Well, what can you do, you know?
Yes.
But it's interesting, you know, because the thing is, why do we need transparent mice?
I think it's so maybe it can eventually lead to humans so we could see diseases more clearly. If they took a pill and they become, we can see their nerve waves in a different way. It's almost like giving yourself a CAT scan.
Right.
So it's very interesting. I don't really know why.
Yeah, but that makes sense.
Yeah. I made it sound good.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, you spinned it.
Sounded great.
Awesome. In a few minutes, we have a guest sitting here, and we're going to be joined by him in just a moment talking about important things, actually.
It is
a movie. I know, but it is a movie. It's just a very serious movie, I think, and it deserves a lot of attention. So there you go. A couple of things. You may have heard of this. This man was trying to impress his date in Pittsburgh. Mm. So he decided to jump off a roof for her. And my question is, why?
Right.
Why would you do this, right? So he ended up being wedged between two buildings.
What a jackass. He deserves that shit.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
But, I mean, they had to rescue him and break down walls and stuff. I mean... Yeah, what's he doing?
Were they drunk? Was he on drugs? Or was this
I don't know. They're not saying. Okay. But the thing is that didn't the girlfriend or the date think anything of it? Like, tell him don't jump or something?
Right. You know? Like here's the deal. You know, men tend to do these things where they're jumping off roofs or big things to prove themselves. And I'm like, I've never met a woman that's like, but did you see him jump off the roof?
Right, exactly.
I am horny for that guy. Like, no interest in that. But if you can, like, open a door for me, I'm turned on.
So that's a Superman for you.
I think so. I think you're trying. I think the testosterone has gone in the way that isn't helpful to today's women. Jumping off roofs might be cool at frat parties, but it doesn't turn a woman on.
No, it doesn't. No. And there's a lot of things that don't turn a woman on that guys think they do.
So many.
Yeah, you know, like sending penis pictures to girls.
The dick pic,
I understand,
I don't get.
They don't like that, right?
Because to be honest, the penis isn't that attractive. Like, if it was an attractive thing, I'd be like, bring it on. But I'm like, ugh. Not this again.
Well, maybe that's debatable. I don't know.
Tweet us.
Yeah, but the thing is that, you know, when you, I don't know, I better not go there. But
you saw him slow down and then just stop.
Yeah, because I'm thinking, you know, it's like guys go for body parts.
Of course, breasts women are beautiful.
Women don't go for body parts, right? They want to see something attached to it.
Yeah, maybe some like smarts, brains, money, happiness. I don't know. Men are also very visual.
Right.
And women are much more emotionally balanced. And also, women's bodies are gorgeous.
Yeah, that's true.
Like, a boob is phenomenally more attractive
boob
than
a boob is phenomenal and asses and everything else. Yeah, in between.
But a dick? Ugh.
Yeah, well, I don't know.
No. Some people like it. I agree. I mean, I like it. I'm just saying I don't think I need an image of it on my phone.
Yeah. No, that's true. I don't argue with that at all. And I mean, it's not a... I don't know. I mean, some people may enjoy this, you know. I keep on always going back to those porn stars that I've met because they're so different from traditional
other people.
They call us civilians, you know. And... So
wouldn't it be weird if porn stars turned to be aliens? Like every porn star was just a real alien. They're not from the U.S., the Earth.
I know, yeah. My genitals are meant for abuse, folks. Yeah. I mean, my God, you know. But but they talk like guys, you know. So that's what I'm saying. I mean, sometimes I just don't know, you know, because everything you might generalize about women, they're like the exception, you mm-hmm. know.
I think there's exceptions to every role, yeah. though. Always. There's yeah. always that, you know, you can't all generalize one people. Right. I think porn stars when, I mean, I don't know. I'm not a porn star. Although I have a great porn star.
Thanks for clarifying that. We thought for a moment.
But I have a great porn star name. Uh-huh. You take your very first pet and your first street that you lived on. And mine is Scampy Allendale. And it's so cool. I think they're just surrounded by that, so that's all that's the language they speak. Right. The currency is all sex, 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 sex.
Right. And that's probably why they got into it too. Is yeah. maybe, you know, I think in private life they're probably into it too, you know. I mean, you have to love sex in order to get into porn.
If you didn't, you know? I think it would be a terrible
it
position
would be,
for you.
Right?
What are you yeah. doing?
It's a terrible decision anyway, yes. though, I think. You know, it's a one-way door. You know, you can't go back once the genie's out of the bottle. That's it. You
it's
know?
True.
Your pictures up and
You're
videos are up there
star.
Forever, you know.
But they make some good old money. I don't really know, actually.
Yeah, you see, that's the thing. That's another myth, you know. Unless, you know, maybe there's a couple big stars that might make maybe $5,000 a movie or something.
I see, but mostly it's just...
But mostly, yeah, I think per scene they get between $500 and $1,000 or something. And then it goes up if you do an anal.
Oh,
and,
you phase me.
Yeah.
It should go up. No, I feel like if I ever audition, they'd be like, you be the extra in the coffee shop. I'm like, all right. Like, I could never make it. In headshots, when they're like, look sexy, Tori. Go ahead. Look sexy. I'm like, ooh? Like, I don't know what I'm doing.
Yeah, exactly. Like, what am I supposed to do?
I have no idea.
Stick out my tongue.
I don't know.
You know,
I
spread my lips.
He's like, you look scary. You look scary. Don't do that. All right. Don't tell me to look sexy. I don't know how to do that.
Well, that's good. I think that's a good thing because some women, that's all they know how to do.
I know the duck lips, my God. The selfie duck lip sexy thing. I look ridiculous.
Right. Everybody does that.
Everybody.
What's that? You know?
It's very weird, but it does make your cheekbones look phenomenal.
Mm.
It stretches, so you got some good old little cheekbones, but I don't know.
All right. I guess there's always advantages and disadvantages to everything, you know? So at Fox News, they're facing more sexual harassment stuff.
Yeah, I read that it was like just like a frat over there.
Yeah, that's what the suit is claiming.
Yeah.
You know, this time it's brought by what's her name, Andrea, I think.
I don't know her last name.
Yeah. Oh, Andrea Tinteros. Mm. Okay, and she filed a suit alleging she was sexually harassed by former network chief Roger Ailes, which he was also accused by Gretchen Carlson.
Yeah, several other women came in. I mean, Ailes is just kind of a
scumbag. They let him go, yeah.
Yeah, he's a scumbag.
Yeah. But you know, you never know, because the thing is that it's like a he said, she said, you know?
Yeah, but here's the thing, and I hear that. I really respect that, and I hear that with Cosby when it first started coming out. It's a he said, she said. How could Dr. Huxtable be this guy that puts things in my coffee?
That's true.
But when the flood doors open and that many women are, like, coming out, I have a hard time thinking that many women are that stupid and would put themselves out there. So when 60-plus come out for Cosby and say, no, this did happen, when do you start believing them?
No, absolutely, you know. But what I'm saying is that they're making Fox look bad, where we're talking about one person here.
But apparently what she said was, today in the Post, it said it's a culture that was there of just, like, sexual harassment that was ongoing. Show your legs. And it was like a frat party and no one said anything.
Yeah.
So now that it wasn't just Ailes, it was the entire cultural environment. That
right. Again, that's what the suit claims,
right.
though. You know,
you're right. Allegedly.
Yeah.
Allegedly.
Because you know, they could say whatever they want. I don't think from what we know, I don't think you can extrapolate that the whole network is like that. But
exactly.
Maybe it is.
No,
maybe
true.
It
maybe
is.
They
I mean, look, they hire all these beautiful blonde women.
They're so
maybe
thin.
There's something to it.
Get a sandwich. They are so thin. They look so beautiful. But I mean, it's funny because I think there's got to be some kind of evidence now with, you know, iPhones and stuff. They've got to have some, or emails of stuff that shows a culture, or else a systemic culture of sexual harassment.
Right.
And yeah. if they, but this is alleged. We don't know.
Yeah, exactly.
It could be a really feminine power place at Fox.
Right, yeah, because, you know, apparently she was fired and, you know, and now they're saying it's because she was fired because of the book, then she's publishing a book that she didn't get approval for and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. So
it could be some anger, some resentment.
Yeah, so we'll wait and see, you know. I mean, I don't know. I'll tell you why I'm sensitive about these things, because as a man, you often think all a woman has to do is accuse you of something.
It's over.
First you'll get arrested, then they'll start asking questions.
It's so true. And your reputation can't come back from that.
Yeah.
The credibility's gone. Absolutely.
That's what I'm saying. So just don't piss women off. That's all I can say, you know?
Let's just be nice to each other.
Exactly.
It's really, really a good
don't
idea.
Put them in a position where they're going to have to treat you like this.
Right. And it's, the frustration comes from when a man is misdiagnosed as being sexually harassing. But at the same time, I think a lot of women haven't been able to speak up about this cultural environment.
That's true.
But we don't know. Both are sensitive. It's just a sensitive issue.
Right. No, it is. And I think often women are shamed to come out and
oh, my God.
This,
but as soon as someone does it, that's the bravery. As soon as someone does it, it does lead to a domino effect of like, oh, thank God I can talk about this, you know?
Yeah.
So let's hope things are settled at Fox.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we'll see. I don't watch them that much anyway, so.
I watch sometimes and then I'm like, oh,
Tara. Yeah, it's not for you. No. This liberal over here. Yeah.
I try to get both sides, you know?
Yeah, I know. That's why I have CNN on,
sure.
You know, because they're more like, more balanced than Fox.
Totally.
You know, but yeah, there's still a lot of media that that is on the left, you know. So
yeah.
There's not enough
yeah.
right stuff. But in talk radio, there seem to be a lot more conservative hosts than
mm-hmm.
than progressive.
Yeah.
You know,
it is. It became like a nice little hosting position for them. And then Maddow kind of came out as that radio star, Rachel Maddow,
right?
From radio, and then moved on to MSNBC. But yeah.
Oh, she was on radio originally.
She started as a radio.
Oh, I
Air
see.
America.
Okay.
Al
right.
Franken. Yeah.
Sounds good.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we're going to bring in our guest now. And we're joined by Jorge Valdez. Iga or Iga?
Iga.
Iga. Yeah. That's what I thought. You see, I always got to go with my first instinct.
Your gut instinct.
Exactly. Welcome to the show, Jorge.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. Are you an L.A. native? Do you live here? Are you visiting?
I moved here 2 years ago.
Oh.
I was in Paris before, and before I was in New York, where I made the film.
Oh, really? Mm. And what were you doing in Paris?
Just living.
Oh. Really?
L'amour.
I mean, what is it? Just one day you decide I'm going to move to France?
No, my ex-girlfriend, at the time we were living in New York, and she got a job in Paris, so I said yes.
You said oui.
Oh, wow.
She knew French, I didn't, but I learned a little bit.
Yeah, you have to, right? I know. It's but speaking, do you speak Spanish?
Yeah, I speak Spanish, English, and a little bit of French.
Oh, really? Mm-hmm. So, I think knowing Spanish helps understand French better, right? I mean,
yeah.
I can see a lot of similarities in the languages.
Yeah, Spanish and Italian are very similar, but
true,
I took
yeah.
French and then Italian. I'm like, oh, they're real different.
Yeah.
Yeah. French is a very unique language
yes.
in that they like to put 10 letters instead of one when you write a word, right? So you have to remember all of them, you know? Instead of O, they'll put E-A-U-X-D or something,
it's
sexier. You know?
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, I had a really hard time with French. I thought coming from Spanish that it would be very easy.
Very different.
And I realized that it was very, very hard. It took me like 2 months in classes every day to be able to like just break out and
start speaking.
Conversate a little bit.
And French is way back. And Italian and Spanish are da-da-da-da-da-da. So you got to like figure out your tongue movements.
Yeah.
That's what she said.
Yeah. So you followed the woman to France.
Yes, I did.
Awesome. And you were there for a year, did you say?
Like a year and a half.
A year and a half.
Yeah.
And so now where did you grow up?
I grew up, I was born in Cuba. I grew up in Mexico, Argentina, Spain, Costa Rica.
Wow, so you moved a lot around.
Wow.
Yeah.
Were your parents like traveling a lot?
Yeah, my father's a diplomat. Well, he was a diplomat. He just retired
for
Mexico.
Wow.
Really?
So, yeah, that's where we traveled a little bit.
Yeah, that sounds
diplomat
good.
Son, yeah.
Diplomat son, yeah, excuse me. You know,
in D.C.
We got to give you some respect.
Yeah, man.
I had a huge identity crisis.
Really?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it sounds very sexy, and definitely I'm very grateful for my life, for sure. But it also brought like a lot of issues at some point of like, who am I?
Right. You can't plant roots anywhere, right? Yeah. You constantly be moved around and stuff. And as a kid, it's not very healthy, right? Yeah. I know what you mean. You know, we moved around a lot too, but just because my parents like to move a lot. But
where are you from originally?
I'm from Israel.
Oh, okay.
So even though we moved inside of Israel, but we moved several times. So, you know, when you're a kid, you have to break up with your friends. And
In D.C., I'm around a lot of diplomats' kids.
Right.
And when we got stopped by police for drinking underage, they had a line for the diplomats' kids because they had diplomatic immunity. Mm. And I would always pretend to be a diplomat's kid. And they're like, get back in line. We know you're not a diplomat's kid. But it is hard. They would move all the time. It was very difficult.
Yeah. So he was a diplomat for Mexico, did you say?
Yeah.
Okay. So you guys moved to many like Spanish speaking countries, right?
Yeah.
Is that why? Because it would have been easier for a diplomat, or
no? I mean, my father was not good in English or in French or anything like this, so that limited the places that he was able to move to.
I see.
I mean, I think he would have been fine if he got gone to Italy or Portugal or Brazil or something like that, because it's close enough
You
can pick it up. But, you know, he was moved to Spanish-speaking countries.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Interesting. So now, as your childhood, I mean, did you feel that, I mean, you were missing out on something when you move around a lot? I mean, because I'm always fascinated by this, because we've had several people like military kids and things like that, you know. So how does it affect a child, really?
Well, you know, a lot of therapy has uncovered after the fact that I had a trauma, like, big time. Well,
yeah.
it's a lack of identity, the lack of roots, you know, like, I don't have like the childhood friend or whatever,
exactly.
You know, like, or I do, but like I'm now reconnecting with them via Facebook, and now they have beards and, you know, they're getting married and they have dogs.
I know, and sometimes you wonder, you know, what were you doing with these people when you were young? What was I thinking? But you know, but that's the thing, is that you have friends at different points in your life, especially as a kid, and then you have nothing in common when you grow up, you know?
True.
Yeah, I've had that several times, and then I started giving up on contacting old friends. I'm like, what happened to them?
I love to see my friends on Facebook, like, and see what they're doing. And for instance, like, my high school and middle school friends, like, my middle school friends from Spain, I still get along, and, like, I've gone to Spain, like, in the last 2 years, I don't know, like, 5 times, because everybody's getting married.
Wow.
You know, so like, it's like, oh, and then you have like a reunion. So it's like a reunion thing. And in Costa Rica too, is my high school friends from Costa Rica.
Costa Rica. Costa Rica. He says it so good.
Well, yeah, so how can you say it differently?
I'm like, hey, Costa Rica.
Yeah.
No, I don't.
Yeah. No, it's as though, I mean, it's easy for you to say Tori, but not Tori. Right?
Tori.
Yeah.
I took Hebrew. So it's easy.
So it's easier for you, right?
Easier.
But yeah, when I noticed when Hispanic people pronounce names, they pronounce them the way they actually sound, not Americanized.
Yes.
So Costa Rica, okay.
Yeah. I feel just a little pepper.
Yes. A little marinade in like spiciness.
Because that's the other thing. Like, at some point, I was like, what accent should I speak in, right? Because in Mexico, I spoke like a Mexican.
Wow.
Because I wanted to blend in. In Argentina, I immediately blend in and spoke because I wanted to belong. Like, my whole thing.
Right,
was
that's the thing.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I came here at 16. All I wanted to do is belong. Yeah. And I had an accent, and I still do. Mm-hmm. And so you feel kind of an outsider, right?
But
especially
you sound
as a
like
kid.
A from Brooklyn, more or less.
Ah, right? Very, you like
that's
that.
What some people are saying, but people always where are you from, so but at any rate, so yeah, so I think the thing, I mean, even adults want to assimilate and blend in, you know, so especially a kid,
it's a human trait.
Yeah,
you want to join into a group, and it's hard. You can't even to imagine metaphorically to think, what accent should I use? It's so like, where am I,
right?
Who am I? That's so interesting.
Wow. Yeah. So, yeah, so I can see where identity issues can come up and stuff like that. But you seem to be, like, well-adjusted now.
Yeah,
so.
He's cool
yeah.
now.
Yeah.
Right. He's shaking in a corner.
This is cool. So when was the first time you came to the United States?
Well, I guess like when we did like a road trip, because my family is from up north in Mexico. Uh-huh. So like the first city I went to was McAllen, like in Texas.
Uh-huh.
I think it's in Texas. Yeah, I think it's in So it's like a 9-hour drive from my hometown, from my parents' hometown.
Right.
Which I call my hometown even though I only spent summers there. Like if you have to place,
you have to pick.
Yeah, you have to pick something.
Exactly, right? Yeah.
So my hometown, so it's like a few hours away. And I remember, like, compared to Mexico, like, the difference, the stark difference in, like, the technology. Yeah. And they had Nintendos, you know? And, like, and we bought a Nintendo. And like, the games that hadn't come out. Like, right. It was so bizarre.
There's nothing like America when you're somewhere else, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, America is just like, you know, I remember as a kid, we'd have, like, American immigrants that came to Israel, and they'd bring all these cool toys and everything. And I go, wow, you know, I need to be in America, you know. So when my dad offered that at 16, when he suggested it, I said, okay, I'll take it. I didn't realize what I was getting into. But, yeah, at 16.
It's not all Nintendos, is it?
Yeah, no, it's not all Nintendos. But when you come at 16 to a new place, it's an unusual situation.
Absolutely.
You know? So, yeah, so I had to assimilate and find my way in, you know.
You spoke English before?
A little bit, yeah. Yeah, I knew enough to get around and stuff, you know, because I had been learning English since fifth grade. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, you know. I also took some French in school. That's why I know a little French as well, you know. It was nice because if you excelled in English in school, they would let you take French too.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
So and you moved to Los Angeles? Or?
I moved to Vegas, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, from Israel to Vegas.
Oh, wow.
It was two options.
Two different deserts,
yeah.
You know?
Wow. Because I had to move somewhere where I knew somebody, mm-hmm. you know? So I had family in New York City and in Vegas, and I'd been here the previous year, and I thought, I can't live in New York. It's too big for me.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
it's overwhelming for you.
Yeah, and it's old and dirty, and at least it was like that in the 70s.
Mm-hmm. It was
Today it's a lot cleaner.
Yeah, it was rough.
Yeah, it really was, you know? So I picked Vegas. It was a lot more manageable for
me.
And Vegas in the 70s was heaven, man. I mean, we were partying like crazy, you know. Imagine high school, 70s, music, pot.
It sounds great.
Yeah.
It sounds fantastic.
That was sex, drugs, and rock and roll.
There you go.
That was the time, yeah. So, yeah, so I grew up in that culture. And got totally corrupted by Americans. But this is where I wanted to stay.
You went to Vegas, come on.
Yeah, I know. Vegas was so much fun then because it was a lot smaller, you know, as you can imagine. I mean, we're talking 40 years ago. Mm-hmm. It was much smaller. Today, I can't really stand it. I don't really go to
I was going to say, like, how do you compare to now? Because I went once and I wanted to get out of it.
Yeah, right?
ASAP.
People can't spend more than a day or two there.
2 days max, I'm out.
Right?
You know, I lose my money.
Much,
all right, I'm out.
I know. And I never even go in the casinos because I, you know, when I lived there, I knew if I start playing,
I'll never stop.
Well, good
and
for you.
Yeah, you know, and I had a couple friends who were broke constantly because they would go and cash their paycheck at the casino and leave all their money there, you know? That's terrible. But so I don't really go to casinos. They don't really interest me. I feel I work hard for my money. I can't leave 500 or 1,000 bucks there, you know?
Very smart.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'd rather spend it on something else.
Mm-hmm.
So when you go there, yeah, what's there to do? You know, I kind of go back. I visit a couple of areas where I used to live and stuff like that. Everybody's gone because it's a very transient town.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
but what did you do in Vegas when you were?
Well,
16?
I was in high school, you know.
But afterward, like what? I mean.
Oh, so then I moved here to LA.
But the casino, you didn't do the casinos.
Didn't do the casinos.
So what would you do?
Oh, well, you know, you have like a social life there and stuff, you know. I mean, people do live
restaurants,
there, you know.
I find it hard to believe. Because all you see is the strippers and the.
Right. You know, we stay away from the strip completely, you know. Yeah. I mean, today it's a madhouse there.
Yeah,
you can't
it's a
even,
shit show.
Yeah,
it really
it's like
is.
A parking lot.
Yeah, you know? Even the pool is like covered with people. And I'm like, oh, God, this is disgusting.
All those pool parties and stuff, huh? I know. Well, back to Jorge.
Yes.
We're talking to Jorge Valdez-Iga. He's the director of a new film called I Was There. And we'll talk about the film in a few minutes. I just wanted to know, how did you end up in L.A.?
After breaking up with my girlfriend in Paris.
In Paris.
Yeah.
L'amour, l'amour.
Yeah.
L'amour, l'amour. But of course.
But of course, yes. After that was, over, I didn't really know where to go. I was like, And it was really like spin the bottle, you know, like, and so my, a lot of my friends, because I went to film school in my University of Miami, a lot had moved here. A few had moved to New York, but I had already lived in New York. I didn't want to live in New York again.
Right.
So I was considering, oh, I should move to Amsterdam, or I should move to, like, you know.
There's a place.
Been there four times.
Amsterdam is mine. I've been there four times, too.
I love Amsterdam.
Yeah, it's a wonderful town.
It's like a everything is there. You know?
Everything is there.
And it's an airport that takes you to everywhere. Like, you know, if I had to shoot something, I could just jump in a plane. So that was a very attractive destination. But then my friends from L.A. were like, dude, just come to L.A. You're a filmmaker. You should at least try it for at least a year, or at least 2 years.
That's
just come for 2 years. So I came, and at the beginning, I really didn't like it. You know, like I got an Airbnb in Venice Beach first to, like, you know, see the town. But I was also so depressed from the breakup that it was like
nothing can look good.
Nothing would look good. It was like, it took me like months to, like, you know, I watched like all the TV shows on Netflix in the bed, you know,
eating ice creams.
It was awful. Like I didn't see the light of day. LA is beautiful. I'm like, yeah,
screw it.
Yeah. Well, it's hard, you know. I mean, you move to another country with a girlfriend, and then you break up, and you end up alone, and you're like, what am I going to do, you know? And I know, I've been there, you know. It happened to me, too, in South Africa.
Oh, wow.
But, yeah, but I immediately found somebody else, so it was okay. But I know what you mean, you know. I mean, it'll bring you down if you're really into your relationship and everything. It can be devastating, you know. So you came here at a bad time in your life. Mm-hmm. But so how long have you been here now?
It's going to be 2 years. Actually, 2 years now, around now.
Oh, yeah. Okay, cool. Yeah. And you probably got, like, visas everywhere, right? I mean, you travel all over the place here.
Well, yeah. I mean, now I have an American passport.
Oh, nice. Cool. How many passports do you have? Probably, like, 2 million, right?
Jason Bourne.
Yeah. I have, like, many duplicates. Yeah. One in French, yeah. No, I mean, I had a Mexican passport. I had a Mexican diplomat passport, which was really cool.
Yeah.
I only used the immunity once, by the way.
Like, what was it? First time you got pulled over?
I was driving my father's car and I didn't turn on the lights, so they stopped me, and then they're like angry because they can't do anything.
No, you can't do anything.
Yeah,
it's crazy. My diplomat friends would be like, "What up, cops?" And I'm like, "Damn you! You can get away with anything."
Yeah, until you get home, and then your dad is like, "Hey, what the hell?" But it was just like the lights; it wasn't doing anything
that's
crazy.
Good.
Yeah,
right. That's good. So you became a filmmaker. At what point in your life did you decide I'm going to get into this?
Was it
like a conscious decision for you?
No, it was in college. Like I was a painter all my life. I wanted to be a painter. I was like the kid who was good at drawing and things like this. And my father was like, "No, don't study painting. You're gonna starve."
Yeah, get a real job.
Little did he know that I was gonna end up a filmmaker when you really starve.
Really. I wish I had my paints.
Yeah, I mean, at least with paints, you spend a couple of bucks and you can still paint. Right? To make a film, you have to really rally things around, right?
Right.
So when I was in college, like I applied to film school just because, like, we thought it was going to be cool to be to just study it. But then I realized that I was actually good at it. Like, I had never picked up a camera in my life. I was, like, you know, 19, and for the first time I was picking up a camera, or 20, I don't even, like, in second year in college. And I liked it. I liked it. When I saw the editing machine, to me, it was the most mesmerizing thing. Like, the idea that you put images into a computer and you can see it on a timeline, you can cut on a timeline. To me, it was like magic.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. So you got into it when there's already digital editing and everything.
Yeah, it was kind of it was like the second year into the transition. Like, so it was the Avids, and had just transitioned away from the ones with tape.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So it was kind of magic. Yeah.
Yeah, I know. The tape thing was a mess, man.
Yeah.
I remember that. I know. Computers have transformed everything, you know. I mean, it's amazing. I told you I'm reading books on the future and stuff. And it's really amazing what people predict for us, you know. I mean, it's just, you know, amazing when you think that we can't possibly predict what's going to happen, you know.
Imagine in the last 100
years. People are trying,
imagine what's going to be in the next 100 years.
Yeah, you know what
I mean?
I know.
Imagine that.
So, yeah, who knows where we'll be, but
I remember putting a CD in a computer and burning it for the first time, like downloading it and taking the CD out, but the music was still in my computer. How is this happening? I could not understand. But
that's
whatever.
Funny, right? Yeah. So after college, you decided what? You're going to actually make your own film? I mean, did you from the beginning decide I'm going to do it my own way? Or did you go work for somebody in the beginning? How did it work out?
In the beginning, I was kind of like spoiled a little bit because in college I was getting like prizes for best film, best director. So, and before graduating, a woman came and offered me to direct a feature film that she had money. So in school, I was like, I thought I had already figured it out. Like I was already graduating with a film. Like
you're the man,
you know, like with a contract and everything. And then, like a few weeks before graduating, she pulled out because she divorced her husband, and like now she was gonna do something else. And I was like, okay, but I was like, okay, well, I'll just wait for the next one to come.
Yeah, it'll show up.
You know, I was very good in school, so so after a few months of like nothing, I started to become a camera assistant, just doing anything, really anything. So a friend of mine hired me to just load film and like really whatever. And I started to fall in love with the camera. And a friend of mine was in New York. I needed an assistant camera. So I was like, I'll go to New York because I've never been. And yeah, I want to go. And so I was working in a music video. And as soon as I landed in New York, and I was we shot under a bridge. I can't remember which one now, but I think it was the Williamsburg Bridge. And I fell in love with that city. Wow. It's like a drug. It was like, wow, it's so fast paced. Now I go and I can't stand it.
Yeah, that's how we said that before. We can't go back. I used to live there too. And now I'm like, I can't go back.
It's too much.
Too much.
You get just landing on JFK.
I can't handle it.
And the cab, you see.
I'm like, can I not get a cab? What's going on? Where's my Uber? This is terrible. Man, things are going in fat, double speed.
Yeah. It's really fast.
Yeah. So great, and then you decided to do your own project, right?
Yeah.
Was this film your first project, or did you do things before?
No. So when I went to New York, I was working. I was doing camera stuff, and I met this guy in Arri CSC, which is like a rental company, and they had just come out with like Arri at the time. Arri is like a camera company, right?
Okay.
One of the three big ones, and they were coming out with the first digital, like big camera, which is now the Arri Alexa, like which is like one of the three ones that use Game of Thrones, anything was shot than that. Mm. But it was like the first one coming out, and they needed to test it, and or they wanted footage to promote it and whatever. And so I was like, I'll take the camera. Yeah.
Do it.
And they were like, oh, but you know, who are you? You're a camera assistant. So I had a reel on me because I had like the DVDs. And I gave it to him, and then they're like, "Oh, I didn't know that you were a director, and that you're good." So yeah, take the camera, take all the equipment. So
always be prepared with your real people. Yeah. That is a lesson.
There you go, and be confident and meet the right people too. Yeah. Very important.
Yes,
very important. So so you picked that up, and what did you do then? Did you decide you're going to make a movie?
I did a short film over a weekend, and so there was a little time span where I could do the film. Like they were like, you know, we needed to do it now because it was like in the winter. So it was you know, the time where it was slow and they could afford to give me that plus, you know, $20,000 in equipment or whatever, like rental. So they said yes. So we I shot a short film and it got into the American Cinematographer magazine.
Wow. Really?
It got a little like a 3-page spread.
Wow.
2008.
Yeah.
And from there, you know, somebody recommended me for a job directing a feature film, and because I had that article, it kind of gave me credibility. Mm. So my first gig, I owed it to recommendation, but also that article.
Wow!
So I did my first feature film was called Hotel Chelsea, and it's a Japanese feature film. It was premiered in Japan in theaters, and it was on DVD, and it was shot in New York. And so the Japanese production company was looking for a director in New York City. Mm-hmm. And somebody recommended me, a friend of mine, Sonia Huang, recommended me. Uh-huh. And that was my first feature film.
Wow, how cool is that?
It's all recommendations and recommendations. I mean, if you put your manifest that you meet those right people, it's crazy.
Yeah, you do need to be out there and meeting people.
Take action.
Yeah, you know, you can't sit home and put, you know, just put up a sign, I'm an actor, and wait for the work to come to you or something.
Oh, yes, for actors especially. Now it's like you can shoot yourself anything you want. Like, I think, and it's great that actors become directors now because they also understand the other side of the camera. When you have a director, also, like, sometimes I take acting classes all the time.
That's great.
So to become a better director of actors. That's how I met James and all the cast from. I was there, by the way.
Right.
But it's very true that we should all learn all sides.
Absolutely.
It's very, very important.
Absolutely.
Right. Well, we better get to the film at hand here, folks, because we're quickly going through our time here. And Jorge Valdez-Higa directed, did you produce the film as well?
Yes, I was one of the producers.
Really? Mm-hmm. Wow. So the film was called I Was There, and this is a story about 9/11. Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit about the plot. What does the film involve?
Sure. So the film is called I Was There. It's about a firefighter that escaped from the towers, uh-huh, and survived, but nobody knows this. Everybody thinks that he was a hero, and he's unable to say that. So he is dealing with survival guilt from all his colleagues that died and everything, but also with an image portrayed of him that isn't true. Mm. So he becomes an alcoholic. So to everybody, he's a hero, but he knows that he was a coward. And he's dealing with survival guilt. It's something that hasn't been touched lot in films. Mm-hmm. This post-traumatic stress and the survival guilt. And his life is a mess. Like, his wife left him, his son left him. You know, his son went to Iraq to fight for him, and came back with also post-traumatic stress. Mm-hmm. You know, but this guy is in shutdown, and he meets this photographer that when he was going up the stairs, he took a picture of him.
Wow.
But he never published these pictures. And he published these pictures 10 years later. So, like, the film takes place 10 years after 9/11. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And where this photographer publishes his pictures. And Gus, the main character, played by James Lee, gets very angry at him because he knows, he remembers that he has a picture of him. And he uses that picture to blackmail him into Road of Redemption.
Wow.
So he says, like, you have to tell your wife, your son, and everybody the truth.
Is he doing that out of malice or to help him?
To help him.
Oh, wow.
To help him. In the beginning, it looks like it's like malice, like he's an antagonist, but he's kind of like coaching him into
go
back in life.
The mentor he needed.
Correct.
Wow.
Very interesting stuff.
Who
wrote the film, the script?
So the story is originally from James, the main actor.
Oh.
I was in the Susan Batson studio at the time taking classes, and he was there, and that's where I met him. And he pitched me this story of this firefighter that he was putting together a one-act play. He didn't know what to do with it. And he pitched me the story, and it was a Friday night, and I stayed up until 5 in the morning with him, and I was so engaged. He was so good at this. He had all the character work already done and layered. Hmm. So he was already the character. He was a firefighter.
Right.
So he pitched me the story, and over the weekend, we wrote it. By Monday morning, we had a complete outline. And we shot the film like 2 months later.
Wow. Yeah. Don't sit on your ass, people.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
So is this a full feature film?
It's a full feature film.
Wow.
Wow. That's a lot of work.
How long did you shoot it for?
19 days.
Damn.
19 days. But in a way, like, that's all, you know, you need a good story. Also, like, the great act. I was in the studio with tons of great, talented people.
Yeah.
Like, it was just, it was
picking.
Yeah.
Yeah. I write really fast too, so I work really fast, so I like doing stuff. Like, I don't like to wait; I like to move. But it's great when you're in a studio, or if I'm in like a stand-up class or whatever. It's great. I just go you, and you be in it. Done.
There you go.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah,
that's why.
And especially like not waiting for somebody to give you permission,
that's right,
or approval or anything like that. You just get out and do it yourself.
Self-generate.
Yeah, there you go. And so you guys can see the trailer for the film at iwastherefilm.com. There's a trailer there. If people want to see the film, have you guys started distributing this at all?
Coming out soon, right?
We don't have a distribution deal in place yet. It was just premiered in Italy in the Fuji Film Festival, which is a small festival 30 minutes away from Rome. Beautiful festival. Mm. And it was also premiered its U.S. premiere in the Rhode Island International Film Festival,
that's right,
like a week or two ago, which was very, very, very nice. It was the first time I saw it with an American audience, with a full audience, and seeing that the work resonates with people.
Especially Americans. I mean, it must be really different to see it.
Yeah. Well, the Italian premiere, unfortunately, I missed my connection flight because the plane was late, and I missed
world premiere. How terrible is that?
It was horrible. I had the Q&A the next day. They set it up for the next day.
But
it was like they were asking me all these questions, and they looked engaged, but you kind of don't believe that they liked it.
Totally.
Until you saw, when I saw it in Rhode Island with the audience, and you see everybody crying and laughing.
And the energy, you feel the energy. Yeah.
And they came up and took pictures with me. I was like, wow, okay, the film works.
Good.
Yeah. So you were one of the producers of the film as well. How many producers were all together?
I think it was five of us.
Five producers?
Five of us, like, putting money or, like, services into it.
Right. I mean, but isn't that difficult to get anything done with so many people?
Oh, I see.
No, so many cooks
in the kitchen.
Yeah, so there was, I mean, it's really the director that has, like, the creative decision-making, but there was one production manager. And really two producers that, like, were overseeing, like, me and another friend of mine, Sebastian Zurita. We were, like, the overarching. We were, like, the ones that cutting the checks or anything like this. And the right. But the once, like, we started production, the production manager, Brian Stream, which was amazing, he was, like, taking the ship. Him and the AD, Ricardo Gaspar de Alba, they were, like, running the show.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, awesome.
You need a leader.
Yeah. How did you get all the crew and the cast and stuff? I mean, did you guys have to actually go in and... I mean, I know casting actors, I know how that works, but how did you find, the rest of the crew, you know? I mean, well, I don't know what I'm asking, actually.
Yeah, the cinematographer and everything.
Yeah, things like that. Yeah, the people that worked with you.
Right. So, in that summer... I wanted to make a film. I was going to do another film with Sebastian Zurita. Sebastian Zurita is a very big actor in Mexico. Mm-hmm. Okay. And we had a package together to do a film. And the deal didn't go through. And I was like, I'm going to do a film. I don't care. Mm-hmm. I'm going to get actors from this studio and I'm going to make it. And I was actually writing something else. And James pitched me this story. And I was like, this is perfect. And we can put this guy in this role. So the cast kind of was almost there. Oh. The crew... started trickling in. Like, my friend Philip Friesenbichler, who is an amazing DP that lives in Los Angeles, found out that I was doing a film. And in the beginning, by the way, I was going to do it with, like, a little camera and nothing. And just
that's what
actors.
They always say, like, a GoPro, I'll be fine. Yeah, right. You always think you could do it.
Yeah, so I was going to do it with whatever. And I was going to do it. Mm-hmm. Like, it was not like... because I also know how to photograph and everything, so I can do it. But my friend Philip was like, yeah, I heard you were doing the film. Can you send me the script? I'm like, well, dude, I didn't tell you because you're in LA, whatever. He read the script and he's like, this is great. I want to do it. And I'll come with my red camera and I'll bring my assistant and I'll pay for everything. And if you ever make money, pay me back. If you don't worry.
So an angel appeared, is what you're saying.
Well, he's a collaborator because he also found a really, you know, beautiful project to work on. Like,
that's true.
You know, all of us, I think, like, we do projects for money and projects for passion and, like, something that would further our soul or our artistic endeavors. And he saw this as an opportunity for
this
him as well.
This was a creative outlet for him.
Yeah.
Yes, of course.
And he did a marvelous job. If you see the trailer, you see that it's beautifully shot.
Wow.
Very nice. Where did you get your directors? Were you, like, just talented or did you go to school to learn some of the directing too?
My directing?
Yeah.
I would say, film school. I went to film school.
You did go to film school.
So I did learn the grammar of how to make a film in school by just, and especially just by practicing and just being together with other filmmakers that are learning. So you learn from each other's mistakes, with each other's accomplishments and everything like this. But to really direct, I think it's just, it comes with practice. I don't think I'm done learning. I'm still learning. The directing actors, I think, just from taking acting classes, mm-hmm. I think it's paramount to always constantly stay in the work.
Yeah. How many actors do you have in the film? I mean, you have quite several of them, right?
Yeah.
But the stars are like, what, three guys?
Yeah, the stars are James Lee, Carl Ford, and Sebastian Zurita.
Okay.
Those are the three main cast.
The firefighter, the blackmailer.
Yeah, and the son.
And the son.
Yeah. So the black man, Carl Ford, he's the guy who gets Gus. He's the photographer that gets Gus into action.
Mm. Yeah. Wow. Very interesting stuff, you know. I mean, I can't wait to see this now. So where are people going to be able to see this?
Oh, yeah. So I was answering that question before. So now it's going to screen at the Downtown LA Film Festival. Mm-hmm. We don't have dates yet. Mm-hmm. But it's happening in September, so in the next 3 or 4 weeks, there will be a screening. We will know in the next week, maybe even this week, like what date and what time, and you can the tickets can be purchased online.
Wow, great. And awesome. People can find out about it on your website.
I will update the website to do that.
Okay. Yeah. And I see there's links to Facebook and stuff, so you guys can find out more from the website. The website is iwastherefilm.com.
Is the title about I was there, but he wasn't there? Is that sort of the idea of the I was there?
Well, this idea that the people were there, and all of them were there in 9/11. Mm-hmm. Like this story, like links this 9/11 joined them or brought them together. These mm-hmm. two people, because both of them were there.
Mm-hmm.
Wow,
I was there. That's such an interesting statement. I mean, like 9/11 was the most photographed, documented event in history, and I was there. Was like, I remember watching this. I remember watching this, and it linked a lot of people.
Yeah. Very. So it sounds like a pretty heavy movie, right? I mean, it's like some things you really the stuff they're dealing with is heavy stuff. You know, I mean, the guilt, like you said, you know, the lies, the deception, the blackmail. I mean, this guy went through a lot.
Yeah. I think the important thing here is that it also resonates with all of us because, in his case, it's an extreme situation. But we all have fears that we need to face in our lives. And to become a better person, we need to get a hard look at ourselves in the mirror.
Yeah.
And this is what the film is all about. And it is a very positive film and a very cleansing film. And the idea... what we wanted to make with this film was a film that inspires people to, you know, to face their own fears mm-hmm. and you know, and become the person that they truly want to be.
Mm-hmm. Right, rather than make up who they are and try to endear themselves on other people and stuff, you know, and just yeah, and that's hard. I mean, you know, if you feel like you're a failure and stuff, you know, in a situation like this, what are you going to do? You know, it's pretty depressing. So people have to deal with these things. And like you said, you know, I mean, it's you can't deny that these things happen to people, you know, and the fears and everything. So
I love the idea that the guy who blackmailed him is actually his like guru in disguise. Mm. I love that idea. There's a Buddhist saying that the people who piss you off the most are secret teachers are supposed to be there for you to learn.
Right.
So whenever someone cuts me off in the effing freeway, I'm always like, that guy's my teacher! But it's a cool little instinct about that. Yeah.
Whatever pisses you off about the other person is a reflection of you.
Completely. Right? Which I'm still struggling with, really. I really am. But it is. It's like the one person that gets in your craw is the guru. Pay attention. That's the guru.
That's true, yeah. Mm-hmm. They also say the things that are hardest for you to do is probably your lesson in life, mm-hmm. you know.
And it won't go away until you've learned it.
Exactly. Absolutely. It keeps coming back, you know.
Damn cars.
That's what I'm saying. I mean, God is playing games with us. Oh. You know, this is like a chess game, I think, or something. Or like Sim City, you know? You build a city and then you destroy it.
I really hope it's not Sim City. I really hope that in the end I go to heaven and they're like, it was just Sim City. I'd be so pissed.
No, but I think it is. You know, I mean, if you believe we're we change forms like to a soul and things like that. Excuse me. Then these things, they make sense, mm-hmm. you know? I mean, it makes sense that maybe it's all just an illusion mm-hmm. to make us go through something, mm-hmm. learn a lesson.
My mom grew up and thought she thought someone once told her, what if we were just a giant's dream?
Right.
And she was like, I can't unthink that. That's right. All I can think.
Yeah, like the Matrix or something, yes, you know?
Exactly.
Like it's all an illusion or something, you know? And scientists are saying...
I know, I said
that. That it is an illusion because, you know, everything's made of atoms. Mm-hmm. Atoms is 99% nothing. And the only way they create, like, surfaces and stuff is because they move so fast mm-hmm. and all this. So it's an illusion. Mm-hmm. You know, we're not falling through the floor. None of this is happening. But, you know, we also discovered or people believe that we haven't tapped into the entirety of our brain and stuff, you know, so... I don't know. Who knows? You know, it just sounds like a nice, well-made plan to teach us a lesson or two.
Yeah.
I don't know. But at any rate, it's fun. Life is fun and everything. Jorge, tell people more. So people can go to in LA downtown. They can see this. What if they don't live in LA? Is this going to be available like in other cities? Netflix?
Or online?
And do you have any indication where you're going to distribute?
I mean, I hope that we get a distribution deal soon. This has been just playing in festivals for the last 3 weeks, so it's very early.
It's new.
So people are just learning about it. People are, you know, reviews are just coming out. And we have a sales agent for the film, Media Luna, in the new films, who are in Germany, who picked it up. And we had a screening in Cannes a year ago.
Wow.
So we're just, I think that the strategy is just waiting to get a little bit more buzz before we make a deal.
It's brand new right now.
Basically, yeah.
That's true, yeah. And so, I mean, does it ever happen that that studios will come to you and want to pick up the film, or... Is it usually you have to go to them?
Well, every day I get a call from Universal.
But you're getting one right now.
Yeah. Hold on.
Well, I don't know. If they go in the festival and they like the film, would they contact you? I mean, do you think?
I mean, I would hope so, yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
that's how
do they
works,
do
right?
that? Do you know?
I mean, I think that studios and they have reps that do. There's people that are called like acquisition executives, where like they get a film and they put their name on it and they market it and sell it themselves. And festivals are a medium for your filmmakers to market their films to everybody, really.
Right.
So, like, if you get a good review on Variety or on the Hollywood Reporter, somebody picks it up. There's somebody's job to read those new films and look, scout out for films. Most of the times it has to do with who's in the film, if it's a marketable actor, or if the story or something is poignant right now. It's the 15th anniversary of 9/11, for instance.
And so the survivor's guilt is so present right now, PTSD, all of that. That's very relevant, too.
Yeah. But at the same time, for instance, how do you convince somebody that is watching Netflix on a Sunday to watch a 9/11 film, right? Like, it's also
true.
That idea. I mean, if people would know that this is actually a very positive film and a very, a film that is not like a it is for sure dramatic and everything. But it's a very positive film.
Yeah, it's not a depressing film.
Yeah, it's not depressing. Like, you don't leave like people. That's what I really realized when in Rhode Island, like people left with like they really. And I realized that that's the films that I want to do for the rest of my life. Films that are maybe hard or you know, but they make people think and they make people feel better.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And that's I think what films should be. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, they do things that they tell a story in a way that no other medium
can. They can touch you in a way too.
Yeah,
very much.
Well, Jorge Valdez Higa, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Everybody, check out the film I Was There. Look for it. At least you can see the trailer right now at iwastherefilm.com. And pretty powerful movie, I would say. Jorge, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We wish you a lot of success in your future. And I know you're going to do well. You seem very talented.
Go-getter,
you know?
Too, yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Go-getter.
Of course. So you deserve a lot more. And come back and visit us, you know,
thank
when
you.
You're big. And
you remember our peon.
Yeah, remember your... yeah. Remember us minions.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Civilians.
Civilians. Yeah, we talked about dick pics. He'll definitely remember us.
Yeah, he's like, I can't refer people to this interview. Just tell him to start at 10:15. Anyway, thanks everybody for listening and for joining us. Tori, thank you as always.
Thank you.
And we'll see everybody tomorrow.
Listening to Sam in the Morning, only on LA Talk Radio.